Welcome to Journal Club for October 13th, 2024. I'm Malcolm Dix. Let's pretend that your name is Janet, and you're the CEO of Janet's Bicycle Company. You sell bicycles to distributors, and you make those bicycles in a factory. The raw materials and third-party components come into the shipping dock, and you've got a production or assembly line where you transform that pile of metal and rubber into a finished bike. From the start of the Industrial Revolution, all the way up until the 1960s, the individual tasks involved in a production line like yours were manually done by a human being. That person would likely have been using tools, and those tools might have provided leverage, but at its core, industrial production was still a human-centered manual task. Bicycles, toasters, cars, shoes, tape measures, these were all made by a real person on an assembly line. The first inkling of the change that was to come occurred in 1961 when a company called Unimate released the first mass-produced industrial robot and installed it at the General Motors plant in New Jersey. This ushered in the age of industrial robotics. Since then, myriad companies have released robots of their own, from KUKA Robotics to ABB Robotics to Kawasaki Robotics to Dassault Systems to Universal Robotics and many, many, many more. Today, there are robots performing tasks in factories all over the world. Many of them are in a form factor you'd recognize, a big robotic arm with attachments. So, what's the problem? Well, I'm going to set aside the socioeconomic repercussions of all this workforce automation, as that's out of scope for Journal Club, and instead, I want to focus on the practical and logistical challenges of working with these robots. Let's go back to your factory, Janet's Bicycle Company. You have a fully manual process that you've decided to automate with different industrial robots. You want robots to unpack the truck, robots to prep the materials, robots to cut the tubes and weld everything together, robots to paint the bike frames, etc. So you hire an industrial robotics specialist, and they break the bad news to you. You're going to need a variety of robots from different manufacturers, and that will mean working in multiple different software environments with different workflows, GUIs, API standards, file formats, and procedures. The consultant makes it clear. This is going to suck. That brings us to the motivation for today's article. In it, researchers from Bulgaria and Greece have put forward a universal standard that they argue could and should be adopted by all the manufacturers of industrial robots across the board. It's a standard flow and framework for computer-aided robotic control systems, CARCs, and offline programming environments, OLPs. These are the two types of software that the robot manufacturers and other third parties create so that you can program their robots. Functionally, they're IDEs, but for robots. The standard that the authors put forward in this article is a UX and project management standard for the CARCs and the OLPs. They argue that unifying the disparate platforms around this standard will benefit everyone involved. The authors theorize that the process of building a control program for an industrial robot should always proceed as these six discrete steps: robot selection, end effector selection, additional equipment selection, teaching setting and guiding, simulation and optimization, and deployment. And that's it. No matter what you're having your robot do, whether it's welding a door panel on a truck, or loading a pallet with cardboard boxes, or adding spokes to a bicycle wheel, that's the process, that's the framework, those six steps. Let's look at each one of them in more detail. Robot selection. Two things need to exist in order for a robot to be selected. One, a 3D model of that robot. This is used at later stages to orient the robot within the environment and to simulate or optimize the performance of its tasks. In some cases, depending on the CARC you're using, the robot's 3D model may be preloaded into the system. At other times, it may be something you need to import from CAD. Two, a controller for that robot. You can think of the controller like it's a driver or firmware. A controller enables the physical work that the robot can do. It can, for example, control the servo motors or the pneumatic actuators or whatever else the robot is composed of, but the controller on its own doesn't have any business logic. End effector selection. You know how when you buy a big stand-up vacuum cleaner, it comes with a bunch of attachments that you'll probably never use? Well, these big industrial robots have effectors the same way that vacuums have attachments. If you think of one of these robots as a big metal arm with multiple joints, then think of the arm as ending at the wrist, with nothing past that but the coupling where you can attach an effector. So if you want a gripper that can pick stuff up, or a sprayer that can paint something, or a driller that can put a hole in something, you can find and attach those effectors to the robot. Within the software, the user just needs to be able to select the effector that they want or import it from CAD. Additional equipment selection. At this point, your CARC is going to be displaying a robot with an effector existing in an abstract empty space. When we say that we're adding additional equipment, we're really just filling out that empty void with the objects that constitute the working area for the robot. Will there be a conveyor belt in front of it? Will the robot be mounted on a workbench? How will the physical space be constrained with walls, ceilings, and objects? The reason to add all these things into the CARC is pretty simple. The robots have no idea where they are. Most of them do not include any kind of onboard camera or any way to sense their surroundings. They need you to tell them the space that they exist in. If you don't tell them, for example, that they're positioned just next to a wall, then they might very well hit that wall because it doesn't know it's there. Additionally, now is the time to augment the robot with any mobility attachments it might have that allow it to navigate the physical space. So if it's on wheels or if it's on rails, for example, you put all that in during this step. Teaching, setting, and guiding. The robot now needs to be taught what to do. This in some cases will look like programming. Generally speaking, the robot just needs to know the XYZ position its effector should be in at different periods of time. And it needs to know any subprograms the effector should run at those specific points in time. Here's an example. The gripper hovers at a point just above the area where there will be a bicycle frame and then opens its grips. That would be programmed as XYZ coordinate plus subroutine. The gripper lowers to the ground and closes its grips. Again, that's XYZ coordinate and subroutine. Now it's holding the bicycle frame, and it needs to move it to the painting area. Since it's already holding the bicycle frame, then the only thing that would need to be programmed is the XYZ coordinate of where it needs to go. The CARC will figure out the rest. Most CARCs will also give developers other options. They could use the graphical representation of the robot within the CARC to set the steps instead of programming them manually. Or they could use what's called a teach pendant. This is a physical, handheld device that communicates its position in space to the computer running the CARC. The CARC records the positions as if they were being programmed. Simulation and optimization. All the points that the developer set in the teaching phase, when taken together, constitute an application. Now it's time to run that program within the CARC to check its validity. There are two goals of this. One, to flesh out bugs and validate different use cases, and two, to allow the CARC to optimize its movements for efficiency. Deployment. There is no continuous deployment or push-button deploy concept for most of these machines. Instead, the application needs to be compiled and then physically loaded onto the robot. This can happen through a USB connection or any other peripheral. And that's it. Those six steps allow you to program any kind of industrial robot to do whatever you want it to do in your factory. As you've seen, the difference between a welder robot and a painting robot are just a difference of effectors. Everything else is the same. If you have an assembly line with a diverse set of tasks, like the bicycle company, then you should, the authors argue, be able to go through these six steps for every task for every robot in your factory, regardless of the make or model of the robot or the CARC you're running. That is the idealized world that the authors are proposing here. But as I said at the top, that is far from reality right now. But if the authors' work gets significant traction, that could all change. Thank you for joining me on today's episode of Journal Club. I hope you enjoyed it. Malcolm Diggs signing off. See you tomorrow.